odds are good that you've come across a sunflower before. You might even have one of those iconic big yellow plants growing in your garden. Today we're going to be talking sunflowers, but on a much larger production scale. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Rural Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Albrecht with Ag Country Farm Credit Services, and I'm pleased to be joined by Kevin Capistran, current board member of the National Sunflower Association. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
Sunflowers are found growing in many different areas, but more locally in North and South Dakota and here in Minnesota. What type of climate or soil type are these plants ideally looking for?
So sunflower is native to North America, so sunflowers grow well, but I think they grow especially well up here in the northern plains because of the amount of moisture we get. You don't want too much. A lot of diseases can get started when it gets too wet. But essentially, the deeper soils that we have are good for sunflowers. But sunflowers also thrive in less than ideal situations as well. And so that is maybe why the march of sunflowers keeps continuing west across the Dakotas and out into the more arid areas.
Is it a pretty hardy plant?
Yeah, so sometimes people ask, well, how early can you seed sunflowers? And it's like, well, sure, it's a broadleaf crop. It can get damaged by frost, but it doesn't get damaged at 32 degrees. A couple years ago, it got down as low as, I think, about 20, 21 degrees. My sunflowers were up already, and it didn't kill them. And in the fall, if you want a frost to help with harvest, 28 degrees usually doesn't do the trick. It's usually quite a few hours of low 20s before you actually kill them off. So they're quite frost-tolerant spring and fall. If you're worried about covering the garden or that kind of thing, it's not a big concern. They're tough.
So could you walk us through what the average planting, growing, and then harvesting cycle looks like for this crop?
Sure. So a lot of people plant their sunflowers last. Doesn't have to be that way because of that frost tolerance. A lot of years, I plant them when it's most convenient to plant them. And so other crops in my rotation, like sugar beets and spring wheat, get planted first. But then depending on the year, if it's kind of cool the 1st of May, I'll plant my sunflowers then. If it's already warmed up at that time, I'll put my soybeans in, and then I'll come back and I'll do my sunflowers. They're very forgiving as far as when you can plant them. The earlier you plant them, the earlier they'll finish. And so if you've got a very full season variety, you sometimes want to have them in a little bit on the earlier side. But they'll germinate at temperatures as low as 40 degrees, so it's not as concerning as like soybeans and corn as far as soil temperature to get them up and growing in the spring. Throughout the summer, they don't generally grow super fast to start with, but once they get to about 4 to 6 leaves, they start growing pretty fast. And so your weed control timing is you pretty much want to be done by about 8 leaf stage. So early June, you're taking care of any post-emergence herbicides at that time. Your fertilizer's already in place, and the rest of the summer, you pretty much just get to watch them grow, because by the time that they're 5-6 feet tall and blooming, any other needs they need at that time, you're not usually spraying yourself. It takes an airplane or something that can go over the top of them to add any products at that time. And so the most popular time for most people is in July when they're blooming, because everybody likes to look at them at that time. But I get pretty excited when fall comes around and you see the results of it. The head's full of nice plump seeds and you start getting an idea of what kind of harvest you got coming. And then late September into October is our typical harvest time frame for us.
And of course, we always think of sunflowers as that big, yellow, beautiful plant. And that's, of course, as you're saying, in the blooming stage, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's when everybody calls and wants to know, you know, I got a wedding, where can I take pictures of it? But to me, the prettiest sight is when they're jet black, ready to combine, and you know you're going to get them in the bin and be done for the year. Most people don't think that's the pretty part, but that's the part I like.
So when do they usually lose their yellow coloration?
So depending on the temperature, I mean, if it's quite warm, if it's 90 degrees out, those ray petals, or what the yellow petals are called, may only stay out for a few days on a given head. If you look at the circle inside of that, those are the florets that'll become the kernels. They'll flower from the outside to the inside. So the ones right next to the ray petals are the ones that bloom first, and it can move half the head in a day if it's quite warm out, but if it's cool and cloudy, that head could stay blooming for over a week. And then not every head in the field blooms at exactly the same time. So if you look at from the time the first few yellow petals come out to the last ones disappear, you could probably expect about 2 weeks, depending on how even the field is.
So what are some of the biggest challenges for growing a crop like this?
Biggest challenge is by far disease. Being a native crop to North America, most of the pests are also native. And so at least in, I call it in the East, Minnesota is one of the easternmost states to grow a significant amount of sunflowers. So Minnesota, Eastern Dakotas, disease is our biggest problem. There's soil-borne diseases, there's diseases that affect the leaves, there's diseases that affect the stalk, there's diseases that affect the head. And, you know, many of them are quite complex. Some of them are fairly simple, but the quite complex ones are familiar to other crop producers as well. White mold or Sclerotinia can affect it in many different ways, and it's very difficult to get resistance to it built in genetically. One of the newer ones that was discovered, you know, some number of years ago, but we're really getting our hands around it, is called Phomopsis. That's one that it starts out on the leaf, grows into the stem, and can make a lesion that weakens the stem to the point where the head can tip over on it, essentially. And it's frustrating when you don't know everything about the disease. White mold, it's well known. We know how it works. We just can't necessarily solve the problem. But Phomopsis, we don't even necessarily know how it works in the plants. So until we know that, I'm not sure we can get our hands around how to defeat it yet either. So.
Are you partnering with any type of universities or studies to look
into
this?
Sure. So North Dakota State, South Dakota State, University of Nebraska actually all have sunflower pathologists working towards a solution on Phomopsis. White mold is studied in almost all of the north central states, into Canada as well. And USDA, the Sunflower Research Unit, is headquartered in Fargo, right close to home here. Just the other day, there was a team up from Fargo collecting some Phomopsis samples from one of my fields. So I'm easy at volunteering disease stems at times. That's the easiest contribution I can make.
And we, of course, are coming to you from your farm near Crookston, Minnesota. So for those listening along, getting a little geographic information there. But you mentioned that it also comes from, or you also mix in other crops in your rotation. How easy is sunflowers to mix into rotations for people?
Sure. So, I mean, sometimes we're explaining to people that, okay, so you're a sunflower grower. Does that mean all you grow is sunflowers? Well, obviously not. It's not a crop that you want to plant year in, year out in the same spot. Might even be that way for your garden. Don't plant the sunflower in the same spot as last year. Put them under a different window at the house. Because those diseases are harbored on the residues in the soil. And so the further west you go where disease is less of a problem, I think you can grow in a tighter rotation, but that's still probably 3 years apart. For me here, I definitely wouldn't consider anything closer than 4 years. And more often than not, I'm like 5, 6, 7 years apart. You could probably get by with it in a tighter rotation once in a while, but it will eventually catch up with you. The best sunflower ground is the ground that's never had it on it before.
So could you give listeners a little bit of an idea of the average scale of a sunflower farm? Like, what is the range of a small operation versus medium up to a large? What does that look like?
You know, it's probably going to be a percentage of the acres for any given producer. So, I mean, there's 2,000 acre farms in this area, which is, you know, maybe a slightly bigger than average farm. And if they plant, you know, 10% of their acreage to sunflower or 20% of their acres to sunflower, that's, you know, 200 or 400 acres. And so, you know, depending on who's listening, I mean, an acre is a pretty good sized chunk of dirt for a gardener, but an acre is a pretty small amount for a farmer. And so, for me, if I'm doing a field 160 acres or 240 acres in one spot, gets to be a lot of production because the volume that you produce from an acre of sunflowers is quite a bit. It's not the heaviest seed in the world, and so you don't necessarily talk it that the pounds an acre are the highest amount, but the volume's quite a bit. It's a good sunflower crop. You need the bin space for the same as about 100 bushel wheat crop.
So genetics play a critical role in agriculture, both for crops and livestock. On the crop side of things, GMOs have really taken root with different variations. Are there any GMO varieties of sunflowers out there?
There are not any commercially grown GMO sunflowers. There might be something in a lab somewhere, but essentially there's nothing out in the environment that we know that's GMO. The industry had a conversation about it, said, boy, you know, we could solve some of our problems if we went GMO. But at that time, most of the GMOs were herbicide tolerance, and there was concerns that sunflower has a lot of closely related species, and if you developed a herbicide-tolerant sunflower and it managed to cross with some of those other species, you suddenly have weeds that your popular weed killer wouldn't control anymore. And as it's evolved, sunflower has kind of found its its place in the market as a premium oil. At least that, you know, that's used for oil. And so part of, along with that, is there's a consumer base that wants a non-GMO product, and you already are a non-GMO product. And so as an industry, we're not afraid to say that's where we are, that's who we are. But our, you know, sunflower producers are also producing a lot of other crops, and many of them are GMO. So it doesn't mean that I'm against GMO because I'm growing sunflower. It just happens to be that's where the industry is. It's expensive to develop a GMO, and there's very few players in the sunflower industry that would be able to afford to move that through the process, which is, so it's as much an economic reason as anything else.
What would you say is your favorite part about growing this crop?
There's so many risks involved with it along the way that when you get to the reward at the end, I mean, you look at the national average might be 1,800 pound sunflowers, but in this part of the world, we're more than capable of growing twice that. Versus I look at the national corn average and there's no chance I'm growing double what the national corn average is up here. So it's just one of those things where I think I have the ability to be so much better than average when everything works out right with sunflower. And so it's very rewarding. I mean, both economically, and it's fun to grow a crop that yields a lot. And it's, for me, it's one of the ones, you know, that can fill the bins pretty quick.
We are speaking with Kevin Capistran, who is a current board member of the National Sunflower Association. Kevin, we've spent the first half of this conversation kind of getting to know some of the basics of sunflowers, but let's spend a little bit of time talking about what happens after they leave the farm. What are some of the finished products that come from sunflowers? You've already mentioned oils, but what else is out
there? You know, it used to be it was a very simple breakdown. There was oil-type seeds, and they were black, and there was confection-type seeds, and they had a stripe. And there'd always been the great debate about which ones birds liked. And, you know, birds can eat black ones, birds can eat striped ones, and the favorite one was whichever one was in your bird feeder generally. But the market segments are a little bit blurred essentially now. There's black oil kernels that go into edible markets, and what the striped kernels look like now has changed a lot. And so if we start looking at the different market segments, you can, maybe let's start with the confection kernels, you eat in the kernel, salted, tastes like dill pickle, all the flavors that they put on them. That is still probably closest to the traditional market that's always been there, other than the ones we export, and we export a fair amount of them, close to half a lot of years, and one of our biggest export markets is like over to Spain, and they eat them differently. We eat them by the handful, they eat them one at a time, and so the demand had gotten to be for bigger and bigger kernels, some of them like as long as an inch, and that gets to be a really big kernel. And so the dynamics of what the confection industry wanted in their kernels has changed over time to get bigger and bigger and a certain color. And so it kind of left behind the ones that you could hull out and get the kernel from the inside of it out of. So they developed essentially a new market segment called a con oil. Half the word confection plus oil. And it's just like it sounds. They took a oil type and a confection type, and they crossed them. And so you get something in between. And so it generally still has a white stripe, but not all of them. And it's generally grown for the kernel that's inside. Essentially, think about when you go to the salad bar and you're putting kernel on, that's likely where it comes from. It comes from a con oil now. And so there's this new class, and it brings up a whole host of other questions. So, you know, how do we insure it? Well, it's insured as an oil because there is no con oil class. And so that has gotten to be a fairly good sized market segment because kernel in the U.S., exported to Mexico as well, is a lot of what we grow. And so you take that category, which is kind of a new category, and then you move down to what we used to think was just black oil. You grew them for either bird seed or you crushed them, but they realize that there's a lot of different size variation in that, and so the segment I actually grow for is black oils that are big enough to be hulled. And so I have a great multi-use product. If it works for hulling, great. If it doesn't, they can put it in a birdseed bag, and if I don't want to use it for that, it's still got 42% oil. We can take it down and we can crush it instead. And so I like it because of the market flexibility. But even within the oil type that you intend to crush, there's still big variation there. Worldwide, most of them grow what we call traditional oil type varieties, which have the oil profile or the mix of the acids that make up the oil in a certain band. And then there's what we called mid-oleic or new sun type oils, which is what most of North America grew up until recently. And now we have high oleic oils. And so you hear more about that in some of the other crops as well, are trying to get to the high oleic. High oleic is a very healthy oil. And so for those that don't get their hands around it completely, I said, think of it like whole milk and skim milk. You know, skim milk is oleic oil. It's better for you. High oleic is just like skim milk. Drink that, it's better for you. And traditional oil is like whole milk. It's richer in taste. It's what people expected years ago. And so mid oleic or new sun was like 2%. It was essentially a blend of a high oleic and a traditional to come up with a mid oleic level. But most people don't can really even understand what they're buying when they grab a jug of oil off the shelf. If you go to the big box store and it's got a thing up there, a jug of oil, it'll say sunflower oil on the back. We don't, as an industry, we haven't gotten them to the point to delineate what's what. And so if the bottle is an imported oil from the Ukraine and it's a little darker in color, it's probably still traditional oil. And if that's not what you're expecting, you may not necessarily like it. You're more likely to find a mid-oleic or a new sun oil in that bottle, and then the specialty bottles that are North American origin are probably high oleic, which is very mild. It takes on the flavor of whatever you put it with. And so they're dramatically different products, but yet they all say sunflower oil on it. And so then the farmer is trying to say, which segment do I want to grow for? What are the consumers going to want? And so it's not a simple either or situation. It's really delved at least five different ways as far as where the market has moved to.
So you have mentioned both countries we export to and countries that also grow sunflowers.
Mm-hmm.
What are a few more of those? Who, compared to other nations, who are American farmers' biggest rival, I would say, in this market segment? And where is your target export market?
Sure. So other than, you know, North American sunflower production, South America has areas much like North America. So Argentina is a good-sized sunflower producer. And then Eastern Europe is really the biggest area in the world. And that goes into the Ukraine, into parts of Russia, but Hungary, Bulgaria, all of what we think of as Eastern Europe. And then actually it spills over into Western Europe too. France grows a lot of sunflowers as well. And so that is where a lot of genetics or varieties are even developed and shared back and forth. And so we may be planting a variety that was bred for Eastern Europe and brought over here and it worked. And so the sunflower industry is very global as far as the resources. And the trade is fairly global. I mean, we grow more than enough sunflowers to meet the North American market, but yet there's still some imports, there's still some exports. It's generally been a tariff-free import-export thing across North America for years. Some of that is coming into question now, but for the most part, sunflowers flows freely back and forth to those that want it at the price they want it.
We'll get to trade in just a second. But quick follow-up, we mentioned and we talked a little bit about GMOs before, and you said that there is no GMO technology within sunflowers. Given Europe's large presence in this type of market and they're very anti-GMO, does that also play a factor into why maybe some GMOs haven't been developed? And would that hurt you competitively internationally if they did switch over?
You know, I think the GMO question is, sunflower probably isn't going to ever participate in what we call a GMO proper. And it's maybe not because of where Europe's at or where customers are at. But, I mean, you look at the new gene editing questions. And this is something that just in the last few months, you know, is starting to take shape. Where Europe comes out and says that's going to be fully regulated like everything else. And we've kind of been hoping here that, boy, you're not introducing a foreign germplasm. I was hoping that gene editing maybe held a future for the sunflower industry, and maybe it still does. I don't know that initial decision out of Europe is necessarily going to be a global view on it. There's still room for where this is headed. But at some point, I mean, we need to use modern techniques because there's so much room for improvement in sunflower. There's some crops would just thirst for the amount of genetic diversity we have. There's so many wild, and the species aren't even all annual. Some are perennials. And within that bank of wild species is so many of the things we need, but they don't have the same number of chromosomes. They don't grow at all alike. And so you're talking about maybe a 30-year process to take that identified trait from a wild species and move it into something that a farmer would plant, versus some of these modern techniques could take it down to maybe 3 or 4 years And it's going to be things like that that are going to have to happen if the crop is going to stay competitive. And so those that want to see genetic diversity in the landscape have to realize that it's going to take tools to do that. And I think most people realize genetic diversity is a good thing. It's a good thing to see the occasional sunflower field out on the landscape. It doesn't have to all be corn and beans. And so, you know, whether we call it environmental services of a crop, or, you know, in some ways, sunflower is a great pollinator habitat crop. And so we've touted our benefits to NRCS, saying, hey, this is good for the native pollinators that are out there. Let's encourage its production and stuff. And so there's so many things that sunflower has a good story to tell. And so I think if we could just get over some of the humps with disease, but some of those things are going to take some more modern tools to do. Traditional plant breeding is just going to be so slow to get us there that at some point, yeah, we want to fill that need of, you know, giving the consumer what they want, but give us some leeway. Let us work with some techniques that aren't that out there.
Now, you brought up trade. Obviously, that's a pretty hot topic going on right now. How closely is your industry watching that, and how are your fingers crossed that you're not going to get caught up in this?
Sure.
Battle?
So everybody's watching it, obviously, and everybody keeps evaluating what impact it has on them. And so, as much as 50% of the confection kernel goes over, or confection product goes overseas, and so that's important. You know, we need to maintain those markets, and it's not that China is our market for it. China is actually one of our fairly bigger competitors in that market. And so how things evolve and trade that way is going to be highly watched. But North America and how the NAFTA renegotiations go probably affect sunflower much more than the China dispute does, just because Canada is a good market actually for oil. They take a fair amount of high oleic product up there, the premium type products, because there's a lot of food manufacturing up there that uses those type products, even though they're the home of canola up there. A fair amount of sun oil goes up there, and Mexico uses a lot of the hulled out kernel in bakery products and that type of thing. So we definitely want to keep those two customers happy, because there's not a lot of sunflowers growing in either one of those countries. So they look to us for those imports. If we start having barriers to that, it's going to hurt. And we're a small enough crop acreage-wise, you say, well, it's only X number of tons of product going up there that you're losing out on, but that's significant when you're a smaller acreage crop.
So if someone who's listening along today is interested in adding another crop to their rotation or looking to diversify, what advice would you give them about growing sunflowers?
Hey, try something there. You know, it's not that hard to try. You know, if you've got a row crop planter, you can use that. If you get further west, a lot of them aren't even planted with the row crop planters. A lot of them are solid seeded. It's a very forgiving crop to get an average yield out of. I do tell people, I think it takes some more specialized techniques and jobs to get a much above average yield. But getting an average yield out of it is fairly unintensive.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to listeners out there?
The National Sunflower Association has a website, sunflowernsa.com, which is just a clearinghouse of information for all the things, all the questions I didn't answer for you. And it's very easy to read. It's not technical publications in any way, shape, or form. So if it's a grower that wants to know how to grow them, lots of resources. If it's a consumer that wants to know more on what we were talking about on the different oil types, the info's there. So great resource there.
Kevin, thank you very much for taking some time and speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
That's Kevin Capistran, current board member of the National Sunflower Association. That's a wrap for this episode of the Rural Perspectives podcast, which is a production of Ag Country Farm Credit Services. As always, you can get more great content by visiting www.agcountry.com.